Good morning, everyone. Such a pleasure to be part of this important panel, and I really want to thank the Rabbani Charitable Trust for organizing this panel, but also organizing this conference for years and years. I think my family's been coming here for 13 years or something like that, and I've learned so much over the years from the sessions and presenters, and I'm very happy to be here once again with all of you. So I want to begin with a quote by Baha'u'llah. Baha'u'llah states that the object of every revelation is to effect a transformation in the whole character of mankind, a transformation that shall manifest itself both outwardly and inwardly, that shall affect both its inner life and external conditions. Otherwise, he says, the futility of God's universal manifestations would be apparent. So as we look at this problem of climate change, as we feel a little bit burdened with some of the problems that we're facing, we have to be confident that we are here to carry forward an ever-advancing civilization and to think and reflect about what the role of the Baha'i community is in contributing to the solution of this problem. So we work to effect such a transformation, the transformation that Baha'u'llah is talking about, in three major ways in the Baha'i community. We teach the Baha'i faith to those we meet, we engage in the core activities, and work towards building vibrant communities based on spiritual principles, but also addressing the material needs of our community members. That's the first way. The second way is that we address the injustice we see in the world by initiating social action. Many of us here are involved in social development projects or smaller social action initiatives. And then the third way is that we contribute to the discourses of society. Many of us do this through our professions by becoming experts in our field and applying the teachings of the Baha'i revelation to our work. We also do this through the work of our external affairs representatives at the local, national, and international levels. So in these three ways, we're anxiously concerned with the needs of the age we live in and try our best to contribute to the resolution of problems that the world is facing. While we're learning more and more about coherence in the three areas of this work of the Baha'i community, we know that all three areas are characterized by an outward-looking orientation. All three areas are characterized by an outward-looking orientation, by a commitment to learning through action and reflection, and by humility in our efforts as we learn, as we engage in this learning process. So our work in expansion and consolidation, in the teaching work, in social and economic development, and in contributing to the discourses of the world, all need to progress through small initiatives that we take some action in, reflect on that action, learn from it, and continue to move forward. We know that certain areas of our work require specialized skills, and we saw two specialized individuals this morning who presented in their areas of expertise. And that not every individual needs to be working in all three areas of this endeavor, but that in each area there is something we can contribute to the vast issues that the world is facing. As many of you know, the Baha'i International Community's United Nations office has been contributing to the work of the United Nations since 1948. Under the guidance of the Universal House of Justice, this office is in a unique position to contribute to the discourses of society. We seek to promote and apply principles derived from the Baha'i faith, which contribute to the resolution of current-day challenges facing humanity and to the development of a unified, peaceful, just, and sustainable society. So these are really the goals that we're working on at the United Nations. Let me show you some information. Is that up? So, the work of the Baha'i International Community right now focuses on four main areas: the promotion of a universal standard of human rights, the advancement of women, the promotion of just and equitable means of global prosperity, and moral development, which is woven into all three areas of our work. As many of you know, the Baha'i International Community holds consultative status with the United Nations as an international non-governmental organization with affiliates in over 180 countries, also known as National Spiritual Assemblies. And we represent the 5 million members of the Baha'i community to the United Nations. As an international NGO, the BIC interacts and cooperates with the UN, its specialized agencies, the member states of the UN, and other non-governmental organizations there. While many of us work to influence our areas of work with the teachings of the Baha'i Faith, I've been asked to share with you today our experience in contributing to the discourse of climate change at the United Nations. So I'm going to share with you the story of how we became involved in this issue, the efforts that we made, some of the results that we're beginning to see, and also frame it conceptually with the recent statement or paper that we released, Initial Considerations in the Area of Climate Change. So as you've heard from the speakers before me, the subject of climate change has become a core part of informed debates about the future direction of the affairs of humankind. And this is very clear at the United Nations. It's a subject of ongoing deliberations and has woven its way into all areas of discussion. So authoritative assessments that global warming is unequivocal, directly linked to human activity, that it constitutes the widest ranging market failure ever seen, and that it represents the defining human development challenge of the 21st century have seized the attention of governments and peoples alike. On July 11, 2007, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the UN, called on world leaders to unite on climate change. He said it is time for new thinking. This is an agenda that really affects the whole of humankind. He said, I promise that this challenge and what we do about it will define us. Business as usual is no longer an option. We must reach complete agreement. So these very strong statements are coming out from member states, from heads of the United Nations, including the Secretary General. And as I mentioned, one of the priorities of the work of the Baha'i International Community is in the area of global prosperity, which translates into sustainable development and social development in UN lingo. So as we learned more and became more involved in this field, and Peter's mentioned that we've been working in this area for many years, we started to become concerned about the issue of climate change. We consulted with experts in the field, began working with non-governmental organizations, and noticed that there were some fundamental questions raised by the issue of climate change that weren't being addressed at the UN and in the fora that we were participating in. As the recently released paper of the BIC states, the search for solutions to climate change has revealed the limits of traditional technological and policy approaches and has raised difficult questions about justice, equity, responsibility, and obligation. So we began to ask whether we might contribute to a process that encouraged consideration of the underlying ethical and moral considerations of the problem. Examining climate change from this perspective brings to the fore the role of ethical inquiry in overcoming some of the most difficult questions that climate change raises. As was mentioned earlier, ethical and moral questions are often hidden in scientific or economic arguments. So much of the discussion about climate change has to do with the science of it or the economics. That's often an argument we hear. So we began to question some of the underlying ethical issues. And these are some questions that emerged from our consultation with other individuals, and I'll speak more about that. Some of the ethical questions are, what should determine the responsibilities of individual countries to reach their greenhouse gas, to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions? How can developing countries achieve social and economic development without emitting dangerously high levels of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere? To what extent is climate change precipitated by failures in the economic system? How can excessive consumption be reduced and resources redirected towards poverty alleviation, employment creation, and sustainable resource management? And finally, how can agreement be reached on the value and desired quality of life of future generations? So these are some big questions that we were thinking about. We learned that there were a group of individuals already concerned with many of these questions and found a paper called the White Paper on the Ethical Dimensions of Climate Change that a number of renowned scientists had written on this topic. We began to collaborate with Don Brown from Penn State University, who was the main author of this paper. And he was very excited to work with religious communities in this discussion. We worked with him to organize an event at the UN on the ethical dimensions of climate change. And brought experts from various fields to a panel discussion that we titled The Ethical Dimensions of Climate Change. Considering the Baha'i principle of harmony between science and religion, we felt strongly that it shouldn't simply be religious leaders or ethicists that contributed to this discussion. We, in the paper that we released, we speak about the importance of religious communities contributing to this issue. And we say, however, that this role must unfold in the context of an emerging conversation between the discourses of science and religion. The time has come for the entrenched dichotomy between these two systems of knowledge to be earnestly re-examined. So we need to re-examine the systems of knowledge. Both are needed to mobilize and direct human energies to the resolution of the problem at hand. Methods of science facilitate a more objective and systematic approach to problem solving, while religion concerns itself with those moral inclinations that motivate action for the common good. So in light of this, we wanted to invite an array of presenters to speak on the topic of the ethical dimensions of climate change. So we invited a scientist from Columbia University, an ambassador from one of the Pacific Islands, a UN official, a lawyer, a rabbi, it's starting to sound like a joke, and a Baha'i to all speak to this question. We asked them to consider what the moral and ethical issues of climate change were and what practical difference it would make if they were fully integrated into decision-making by policymakers. Now, before I tell you more about this session, I want to share with you an experience we had as we prepared for this session. We'd heard about the desperate situation, of course, that many of the Pacific Islands were facing in relation to climate change, and wanted to invite one of the ambassadors of one of their countries to speak at our panel presentation. So we made an appointment. I'm not going to tell you which country it was, but we made an appointment with the permanent representative of this mission, and told him about our plans, explained what we were planning to do, and invited him to come and speak at this event. He told us that he wasn't sure he'd be able to do that. And when we inquired why, he said that he felt the rising tides his island was facing was due to increased development along the shores. He said that it was similar to putting rocks in a glass of water, that the water levels would rise. So we were a little bit concerned about this, since we've been reading the scientific reports and hearing all the information you've been hearing, but we didn't say anything. We simply encouraged him to consult with the previous ambassador that we knew was still around and to consider our request that he speak at our event. So a little while later, we heard back from him that they would definitely be represented on the panel and that, in fact, his former ambassador would be speaking. His former ambassador did speak and did a fantastic job explaining the plight of the people of his island. And after the panel, the ambassador that we originally met with came up to us and profusely thanked us for inviting them to be part of this presentation. He said that many people on his island were not even aware of what was causing the problem. They could see the changes, but they didn't know why it was happening. He said that he would like to have a video to show members of parliament. Sorry, it's making me emotional just because after watching this video of what's going on there. But he said that he wanted to have a video to show the people of our panel presentation to connect what we were talking about to the moral and ethical dimensions and show this to the people of his country. And he was also so happy that the Minister of Finance from his parliament was able to be there so that he could take this message back to their parliament and convey the seriousness of this issue and how it was more than just a financial or economic issue, but it was a life and death issue that religions and communities around the world were caring about. So, as I mentioned, we held this panel presentation with a variety of different speakers, and we were very happy that whether it was a scientist or a lawyer or a UN official, they were able to identify the moral and ethical issues in this problem. We were overwhelmed with the response from this event, and I worked closely with Peter Adrians. He can tell you more about it, but government delegates, UN staff, NGO colleagues all came up to us and expressed their appreciation for this approach. They told us that they had been wanting to articulate this but didn't know quite how to say it. And by calling for a focus on the ethical or moral impact of the problem, we'd articulated something they hadn't been able to say. Daily newsletters of the Commission published major articles on the event, and we were told that the presentations would be posted on YouTube. So we're going to show you a very short clip of that, which by now has been viewed, I think, over 5,000 times and picked up by a number of other websites as well. So the clip we're going to show you is Mr. Don Brown, who we've been working very closely with on this subject, and it's just a minute and a half of his presentation to the panel.
And so forth. So the significance of seeing this as a moral and ethical issue is profound, I believe. Okay, and that's why I want to thank the Baha'is in particular for organizing this conference. We all need to encourage people to see this in terms of moral and ethical issues, and not talk about it in the abstract, but in terms of the concrete justifications for doing something that people are not doing. Let me just conclude by the following. Bill McKibben, who is a wonderful writer, about 6 years ago, he wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times, and he said the following: I'm sitting here wondering why Americans don't see climate change as a moral and ethical issue. It makes me think of my parents, who were really good people, but did not get civil rights until they saw the dogs on the bridge in Selma, Alabama. He went on to say, and I believe, and I will end with, it's all of our duties to help people see the moral and ethical dimensions of climate change, especially those of us that understand the problem. We have a particular duty, in my view, to get people to see the moral and ethical dimensions of this problem. The challenge is, what are the dogs on the bridge for this problem that we can help get other people to see? Thank you.
So that gives you just a very short flavor of it, but you can go on YouTube and type in ethical dimensions of climate change, and a number of the presentations from that panel will show up. We held this event at the Commission on Sustainable Development, which is a functional commission of the United Nations. The formal membership of the commission is 53 governments, but almost all countries have representation there. Representatives of civil society organize into various groupings at the commission, and this message of the consideration of the moral and ethical dimensions of climate change resonated with many of the civil society organizations there, and they took it up to advocate as well as the Baha'is did. One of the groups that are particularly effective at the commission is the Children and Youth Caucus. I think I have some. And we often have Baha'i youth delegates come and participate in this youth caucus. They felt so strongly about the issue that they formally appealed to the commission for a new level of global consensus and cooperation among governments, who they felt should rise above political and economic considerations and focus on addressing the fundamental underlying ethical and moral dimensions. So we began to see this language being taken up by many other groups and organizations. And the other thing that happened is that the Baha'i International Community was the only individual NGO asked to formally present to the European Union's Troika about this message of the ethical dimensions of climate change. So all the other groups were in coalitions, and we were asked as individuals to present to the European Union this message of this consideration. So the youth particularly made a very strong statement, and as we were engaging in this learning process and thinking more about what the Baha'i contribution to this topic is, we felt strongly that the importance of education, particularly of junior youth and children, should be mentioned. So you'll see in the paper that we ended up producing, we say that a fundamental component of resolving the climate change challenge will be the cultivation of values, attitudes, and skills that give rise to just and sustainable patterns of human interaction with the environment. So bringing it down to the individual level and the cultivation of the values that are necessary to deal with this problem. The engagement of children and youth will be particularly important, as this population will be called upon to exercise leadership and address the dramatic and complex challenges of climate change in the decades to come. It is at a young age that new mindsets and habits can be most effectively cultivated. So this is the call of the Baha'i International community. And we know that many of you are engaged in this work in holding children's classes and junior youth programs. And we encourage you to consider, when you're looking at service projects for them to become involved in, to look at whether there are initiatives related to climate change that they might want to participate in. So we were off to an exciting start. We had this event, we had the attention of governments and civil society, but now came the hard part. We know it's easy to organize a one-off event, but to continue a process and to contribute to a discourse in an ongoing and meaningful way becomes much more challenging. So we knew that we couldn't stop everything we were doing to develop sort of more of a substantive perspective on the topic. We needed to continue to engage. And while we knew we need more substantive thinking, it was more challenging than we originally thought. We don't want to just apply the Baha'i teachings to a problem in a vacuum. We need to be engaged with them at the grassroots level as well as at policy levels to learn and to reflect and act. So we noticed, for example, in this process that at our first session that we held, we had a hard time having women speakers on the panel. So we thought we need to look into the gender impact of climate change and the role of women in this problem. So at the next event we organized, we continued to speak about the ethical dimensions of climate change, but we highlighted issues related to women and girls. And we speak about this again in the paper that we've produced. One of the most pervasive social challenges, as you all know, is the marginalization of girls and women, a condition that's further exacerbated by the impacts of climate change. And our wonderful speaker last night spoke about this a little bit. Because the majority of those living in poverty are women and the children they care for, women are disproportionately vulnerable to the effects of climate change, and at the same time are grossly underrepresented in decision-making at the community, national, and international levels, where decisions about energy, climate change, and sustainable development are made. So we can consider, for example, that 55 to 75% of deaths from the tsunami in Indonesia were women. 70% of the deaths during the 2003 European heat wave were also women. So we can see the disproportionate impact, but it would be a mistake to cast women as simply victims, as we represent perhaps the greatest source of untapped potential in the global effort to overcome this challenge. Women's responsibilities in families, in communities, as farmers and as stewards of natural resources make us uniquely positioned to develop strategies to adapt to changing environmental conditions. And I'll give you just two small examples of how women have done this. During a drought in Micronesia, women's knowledge of island hydrology allowed for the identification of new wells that reached freshwater. However, they were not normally included in local councils, so initiatives to include them facilitated access to this information more easily and allowed communities to better identify measures to adapt to the drought. Also in La Masica in Honduras, this town reported no deaths after Hurricane Mitch in 1998 because women had participated in an early warning system 6 months earlier, and as a result, evacuations were organized on time. So because we noticed this gap in, we've joined the BIC is a member of the Gender and Climate Alliance, which the UNDP has organized, and we've continued to collaborate and work on this particular issue, an aspect of the problem. So of course, the Baha'is and those we were collaborating with were not the only ones raising the or calling climate change a moral and ethical challenge. The Secretary General of the UN and Al Gore has called this the moral challenge of our time. Even the prestigious Stern Review that was mentioned earlier recommended that societies around the world should embark on a serious and sustained discussion of the ethical issues of policy towards climate change. So the Stern Review, which was very much focused on economics, has also recognized the importance of this. Our goal, however, in contributing to the discourse was not to simply call it a moral challenge, but to bring out the ethical questions underlying the problem and to apply moral and spiritual principles to the issue. As Haldor mentioned, this coming year provides a critical window to contribute to the international discourse on the problem. And so we were invited by Penn State University to participate in an event at the Poznan conference that took place 2 weeks ago, and Mr. Peter Adrian spoke on a panel presentation there. And we've also been participating with the UNDP and the Alliance for Religion and Conservation on a project with religions from around the world to develop plans to deal with climate change. It's taken us a year and a half, but in consultation with experts, in learning from our experience in the area and from initiatives at the local and national levels, we've put together this paper, which is available at the back, at the Nancy Campbell booth back there, called Seizing the Opportunity, Redefining the Challenge of Climate Change. So this piece frames the challenge of climate change as a tremendous opportunity for the nations of the world to take the next step in the transition from a state-centered mode of interacting on the world stage to one rooted in unity, which connects us as the inhabitants of one biosphere, the citizens of one world, and the members of one human civilization. As Haldor mentioned, we are optimistic that this challenge actually poses an opportunity, and that's why we've titled the paper Seizing the Opportunity and Redefining the Challenge. In this paper, we assert that the principle of the oneness of humankind must become the ruling principle of international life. The principle, of course, doesn't seek to undermine national autonomy or suppress cultural or intellectual diversity. Rather, it makes it possible to view the problem of climate change through a new lens, one that perceives of humanity as a unified whole, not unlike the cells of the human body, infinitely differentiated in form and function, yet united in a common purpose which exceeds that of its component parts. So you'll all be familiar with this language of the oneness of humanity, but we've worked hard in the statement to try to apply it to this problem. In order to progress beyond a world community driven by a largely economic and utilitarian calculus to one of shared responsibility for the prosperity of all nations, such a principle, the oneness of humanity, must take root in the conscience of each individual. So we released this statement at the conference in Poznan, and it's also available on our website if you'd like a copy of it. It was well received, and we continued to dialogue and work with a number of other organizations in this area. We were also invited to participate in a seminar on climate justice that Kofi Annan's new organization, the Global Humanitarian Forum, is working towards. So we see this paper as another step in the process of contributing to the discourse. If those of you who might find it useful, we look forward to hearing your reflections and thoughts, and we'll continue to work on it. You'll notice we've said it's initial considerations because we really see it as part of a much longer process. We hope that what we've learned along the way will be of benefit to those of you who are engaged in similar efforts at the local and national level. And just to conclude, I wanted to share this quote of Abdu'l-Bahá, which talks about the long process that we are embarked in terms of influencing political affairs. He says, "The world of politics is like the world of man. He is seed at first and then passes by degrees to the condition of embryo and fetus, acquiring a bone structure, being clothed with flesh, taking on his own special form, until at last he reaches the plane where he can befittingly fulfill the words, the most excellent of makers. Just as this is a requirement of creation and is based on the universal wisdom, the political world in the same way cannot instantaneously evolve from the nadir of defectiveness to the zenith of rightness and perfection. Rather, qualified individuals must strive by day and by night using all those means that will conduce to progress until the government and the people develop along every line from day to day and even from moment to moment." So I look forward to engaging in this learning process with all of you and to the rest of the conference. Thank you.